Today's Teisho will be on case two in the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case two is entitled Joshu's The Great Way Is Not Difficult. Ango's introduction: the universe is too narrow. The sun, moon, and stars are all at once darkened. Even if blows from a stick fall like raindrops, and the katsu shouts sound like thunder, you are still far short of the truth of Buddhism. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the ancestors of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate its profundity. The whole treasury of sutras is inadequate to expound its deep meaning. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to save themselves. At this point, what do you do? Mentioning the name of the Buddha is trudging through the mire. To utter the word Zen is to cover your face with shame. Not only those who have long practiced Zen, but beginners too should exert themselves to attain directly to the secret. Main subject. Joshu spoke to the assembly and said, "The great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. With but a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity. This old monk does not have that clarity. Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not?" A monk asked, "If you do not have that clarity, what do you appreciate?" Joshu said, "I don't know that either." The monk said, "If you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity?" Joshu said, "Asking the question is good enough. Now make your bows and retire." Secho's verse, "The great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phrases, two with one. Far away in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret." So this is a story about that involves a master Joshu. Master Joshu is really one of the great Zen teachers of the Tang Dynasty. He had a deep experience of fundamental reality. We say Kensho, or awakening, when he was 19 years old. And then he went to study with a very respected Zen teacher named Nansen. And so Nansen and Joshu practiced together for almost 40 years until Nansen died. And at the time that of Nansen's death, people assumed that Joshu would take over Nansen's temple. Even at that time, Joshu was quite accomplished and very widely respected as a deeply awakened person. But instead of taking over his teacher's temple, he went out on the road. And he just basically walked all over China and sat with many different Buddhist practitioners, many different temples, and many different groups. Many of his encounters with these teachers and their students are recorded in the Mumonkan and in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. So we have quite a few of these, and there's also a there also is a collection of these that just deals with Master Joshu. So we have quite a record of his travels. Joshu, by the way, was the inventor of the Mu Koan. So Joshu was quite old when he invented the Mu Koan, but it has, since the Tang Dynasty, really been the foundation of koan practice in the Zen tradition. So as you know, in our lineage, we do breath perception meditation, and then we begin to do a Mu meditation. Does a dog have Buddha? A monk asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu said Mu or U. So this is the same Joshu. He's much younger at this time. Records say he might have lived to be 120. We don't really know if it was 115 or 112, but he lived to be quite old. And he influenced a whole generation of Zen teachers. Really, many people regard him as the greatest of the Tang Dynasty Zen masters. So in this case, this story is about his time of traveling on the road and encountering a monk. In the Chan tradition, in the Zen tradition, people are really trying to wake up. And when a teacher delivers a talk, or when a teacher used to deliver a talk in, during this period, students would come up to him after the talk and try to understand what he meant. And sometimes these questions were driven by real concern, and sometimes they were driven by competitiveness. You know, so this is a human situation. So Joshu would come to a temple, the abbot would invite him to give a talk, and in some of the stories it's clear that the student is really sincere and is trying to break through his obstacles. And in some of the stories, it's clear that the person is just trying to give great Master Joshu a hard time. It's like, so you're the great Joshu, eh? You know, let me give you a hard time and see if you're as great as they say. That turns up in these stories too. So anyway, Joshu is speaking to the assembly, giving like a teisho. And in the teisho, he quotes the verses on trust in mind, which we recited this morning. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. So the translation here is a little bit different. Joshu said to the assembly, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And then he says, with just a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity. So, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, but with just a single word, just like one false step, and you can wind up in illusion, or with one single word, you can wind up in clarity, see? And then, you would expect that the great Master Joshu would say, I am the great Master Joshu, and I have that clarity, see? I have been practicing with Nansen for 40 years. Everybody says I'm fully awake. And I have that clarity, and if you work hard, you can have it too. Wouldn't that be nice? But he doesn't say that. Instead, he says, I don't have that clarity. And as you can imagine, the monks are a little surprised by this, right? He's the great master Joshu, and he says, you know, with one word you can fall into illusion or you can have clarity. And he says, I myself don't have clarity. Do you appreciate, do you see what I'm getting at? See? So that's the koan, so really, the heart of the koan. And then a monk says, well, if, you know, basically, if you don't have that clarity, how can you teach anything? And Joshu said, I don't know. I don't know that either. I don't have clarity about that either. The monk said, if you do not know, how can you say you do not have clarity? And the monk says, well, if you don't have clarity, you might have clarity, but you wouldn't even know. So it gets to be kind of a crazy conversation. And Joshu says, well, maybe it's time for you to bow and walk away. You know. One way to think about Zen practice is that there is nirvana and there is samsara. Right? The Buddha in the early Pali Sutras tended to speak about reality this way. So, you know, he said, most people live in illusion. Most people live in a kind of unhappy confusion. And they are competitive and selfish and fearful, angry, envious, lustful, and so on and so on. And he said they live lives, chasing their tails, and the faster they spin around, the more unhappy they are. And he said, you really should step out of that rat race and sit down on a cushion and purify your mind. You know, free yourself from those illusions. And the Buddha did just that. You know, he abandoned, basically, his family. He had a wife and a child. And his family was quite wealthy, so leaving his wife and his child didn't mean that they were destitute. They were living in some kind of very nice place, like a palace. And he set out to find awakening. And he practiced for many years, maybe like 12 years. And he probably left home when he was about 19, which is about the time Joshu left home, it occurs to me. And he had his great awakening when he was basically 30 years old, the Buddha. So during that intervening period, he was working very hard trying to wake up. And I mentioned a few weeks ago that he tried many different, he studied with many different teachers and tried many different practices, including extreme asceticism, which was very popular among meditators at the time. And he nearly starved to death in his efforts to wake up. And finally he had his great awakening, his Dai Kensho. And then he taught for the next 49 years until he died. He taught other people how to wake up. One of the interesting things is the Buddha did not go back to the palace, you know, after his enlightenment. He continued to live very simply, with very few possessions. He meditated, so far as we can tell, every day. His wife eventually became a member of the Sangha. His wife became what we in English call a nun. And his son became a monk. So basically, pretty much the whole family decided to pursue this lifestyle. The Buddha continued to live a monastic life. So one of the conclusions you could draw from all this is that there's something called samsara, which is the way ordinary people live, and it's unhappy. And there's something called nirvana, which is enlightened, and it's happy and free. So, very clear, you know, a lot of the early Buddhist texts talk about things this way. There's samsara, and there's nirvana. And nirvana is something everybody wants, and samsara is something nobody wants, right? So, you know, this way of thinking is very, very fundamental to the way the human mind works, right? So you know, we think of happiness and we think of unhappiness. You know, they're opposites, right? We think of health and we think of sickness, and they're opposites, right? And so, you know, when we practice meditation, you know, often we aren't particularly happy. You know, where maybe we have gnawing anxiety, or maybe we're bitterly disappointed, or maybe we're afraid, maybe we're angry. You know, those are all motivations for practicing. Most people sit down on the cushion because something is missing in their life, or because they feel unhappy. That would generally be the case, you know. It's generally the case that people are attracted to the Great Way because there's something missing in their lives. They sit down and they think, you know, I'm not happy. I'm not fulfilled. You know, and in many cases, people have really serious unhappiness or serious issues. You know, I've done meditation for 40 years. I've met a lot of people. And, you know, over the years I've met many people who, you know, basically were really sitting to save their lives. You know, they had, you know, gone through terrible, terrible experiences. I could tell you so many stories about people who were liberated by practicing Zen. You know, I think I mentioned once that... you know, I was the Jikki Jitsu, I was in charge, I was the Karmadhana, actually, of our temple in Seattle. And I was very young, and I wanted to do an excellent job, and I was a trainee, and I wanted to be an excellent unsui, monk trainee. So, you know, when we would have meditation, I would really patrol, you know, in traditional Zen practice. The job of the Karmadhana is to patrol the aisles when people are sitting. So we don't do this here. I don't really like this style of practice. But in Japanese temples, what happens is that when the sitting period starts, the person called the Jikki Jitsu gets up with a teaching stick, with a stick to hit people with. And the Jikki Jitsu walks up and down the aisles with a sharp eye for anybody who's moving. And if you move, you get whacked with the stick. So people, definitely your heart rate goes up when this guy walks by. So anyway, you know, let me just say that you don't get hit capriciously with the stick. There's a whole ritual of hitting you with a stick. It's a flat paddle. It's like the kind of, a little bit like the paddle that used to be used in American schools for unruly students to give them a spanking. It's made of light wood, so it's not heavy and hard, and you bend over and the Jikki Jitsu slaps you under your clavicle. Usually for most people there's a big muscle under your clavicle. And the Jikki Jitsu hits that, and it makes a ringing sound, which is a little bit frightening. But it doesn't really hurt. And after you've been slapped with the stick, in 5 minutes, it's gone. It's just a stinging, and then it's gone. There's no bruising. But it's psychologically frightening. And people definitely, the theory is people are... going to sit more still and be careful not to slouch on the cushion and so on if they know the Jikki Jitsu has his eye on them. So anyway, I would go up and down the aisles, and I was really trying to be a very good jikijitsu. So, you know, if anybody moved, I would, you know, I would straighten them up, get their posture right, you know, and if anybody moved, you know, I would just go, stop moving, and I would come up and hit him with the stick. And anyway, there was this guy at the end of the row, whose name I later learned was Mick, and he was like asleep almost. He was almost snoring, you know. I guess he was snoring. You can't be almost snoring. He was snoring intermittently, let me put it that way. He was upright on the cushion, but every once in a while there'd be like a, you know. So I said, stop snoring! And I hit him with the stick, right? And then I walked back up to the front, and I stood there and patrolled with my eagle eye. And then I came back down the aisle, and lo and behold, he wasn't just snoring. He was like fallen over on his cushion, fast asleep. So I shook him. I woke him up. Get up! Get up! You know, and I straightened him up, put him on the cushion. And I came back, and he was down again. So, you know, hit him with the stick. So anyway, later I discovered that he had been physically abused by his father as a boy, and he was a narcoleptic. So when it was the end of my ever using the teaching stick again, I discovered that he was a narcoleptic, and that when he would feel very stressed or when he was under in a lot of pain, he would just pass out. That was how he had learned to deal with life. But, you know, the interesting thing about him is that he eventually became a totally different person through Zen practice. And he definitely became a deeply awakened person. And my teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say, you know, he said, you know, everybody in our group knew that Mick had a lot of problems psychologically. But Genki Roshi used to say, this he can be a deeply, deeply awakened person. You know, if he just persists, he will be, you know, a deeply awakened person. He will be able to help so many people. And Genki Roshi was right. You know, he actually did. He walked through fire. He walked through fire. You know, but at the end of it, he is still alive, a deeply awakened person. And you know, Genki Roshi's own teacher was a man named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, very famous, who was basically born in abject poverty. And Genpo Roshi was blind. He had he got some disease when he was a kid, and he went blind. You know. So you can Google him, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, very famous guy. And he got some illness as a child and a very high fever, and at the end of it he had, you know, like he was legally blind. I guess he could see light, but he never could read, for example, because he didn't have that visual ability. And, you know, he was like a street beggar for a while, you know. He eventually became a Buddhist monk and became, you know, deeply awake person. And it was really quite revered all over Japan, Yamamoto Genpo. You know, and so Genki Roshi had grown up with somebody who had a lot of difficulties in life, you know. Yamamoto had been like on the street with like a sign begging, right? And he was fantastically intelligent person. You know, he never learned to read, but he had like a photographic knowledge of, apparently, you know, Webb knew him too. He had like a photographic knowledge of the sutras. So he'd heard the sutras, right? You know, and he could tell, you know, he could take you through the whole sutra. He could, you know, even recite long passages, you know. And so he was this fantastically intelligent guy who was just like, you know, basically, by the end of his life, he really had like an indomitable spirit, you know. But people aren't born with an indomitable spirit, you know. You know, people get crushed, knocked down, rolled over, beaten up, you know. That happens all the time. You know, if you had seen him as a child, you would think this guy has zero chance of having a happy life. Destined for a life like of basically destitution or crime or some combination or, you know, early death. By the way, he lived to be like 100, you know. I also talked about, I've talked about in the past about G.U. Kennett. You know, G.U. Kennett was the first woman to be ordained as a priest in the Anglican Church in England. And then she started reading books by Alan Watts about Zen. And she went to Japan and she studied at this temple where all the monks were, you know, I've mentioned that Japanese monks on the whole are quite sexist. And Japanese people on the whole, I have many wonderful, I mean, Genki Roshi was not sexist. Many of the Zen teachers I know were deeply awake, but you know, the average Japanese man is not necessarily not necessarily living in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. These monks treated her very unkindly, and they embarrassed her and tripped her up whenever they could. But she actually persisted until she woke up. It's much suffering, right? You know, and then she came to California, and she was just starting the Shasta Abbey, and she developed this illness. And the doctor said, "Well, you have 6 months to live," you know, and it's like 35 years later she died. And that sounds wonderful, but you know, she struggled with physical issues for the remaining part of her life. So anyway, you know, one way to think about life is that there is samsara and then there is nirvana, right? The samsara and nirvana, it seems pretty clear. You know, and samsara is really unpleasant, right? It's not just sickness, old age, and death. It's confusion. It's people not being nice to you. It's, you know, on and on, right? It's military dictatorships, it's genocides, it's, you know, and so on. And nirvana, you know, is wonderful, you know, really. I mean, sometimes I've had a rough day, I come in and I sit down on the cushion, and I feel so liberated. It's why I've been doing this for 40 years, you know. I sit down on the cushion and I just feel so liberated, so alive and open. And it's really like heaven, right? And so it seems pretty clear. There's like heaven and there's like hell. But, and so when we practice Zen, what we're trying to do is get from hell to heaven. What we're trying to do is get out of samsara and get into nirvana. It's possible to think that way, right? It's possible also to think, you know, it's possible to think, this is so unfair, right, that I have to go through all this crap, you know. I mean, I don't deserve to be, I don't deserve to have been, you know, Yamamoto Roshi didn't deserve to be born born on the street and go blind at like 9. You know, Mick, my friend, didn't deserve to be beaten and locked in a dark closet by his father all his childhood, right? You know, you could say, you know, it's so unnecessary, right? It's so unnecessary. Why is this happening to me, right? Or, you know, we all get screwed up to some degree, right? You know, we all get caught in these mental loops that, you know, basically it can ruin our lives, you know. We all have, because life is difficult and challenging, we make mistakes, Right? We make mistakes. You know, so one of my best friends was married. He's been married three times, I think, three or four times. And when he went through marriage number two, divorce number two, you know, I got to be his good friend during that period. He was also a Zen practitioner. And then he married somebody else, and then that marriage fell apart. And then I remember talking with him, and he said, you know, I made such a mistake when I left wife number two. You know, we really had a wonderful, wonderful relationship. And it was a classic case of somebody who was, you know, entering his mid to late 50s, and he was a professor, and there was a graduate student who was half his age, and that kind of thing. And then, you know, he had the relationship with that graduate student, he married her, and then it fell apart, and he said, why did I do this? You know, well, I was so stupid to do this, right? You know, I didn't realize how happy I was. You know, why did I do this to myself? And in fact, you know, he could see that he had done this to himself over and over again, right? You know, so this is like another example of samsara, right? We self-sabotage, you know, we take the easy way out. You know, I'm sure we all have a long list of things that we wish weren't the case about ourselves, you know. And you can say, you know, why? This is so unnecessary. Why do we get so tangled up in all this? It's tangled up in samsara. You know, it's so clear that we want to be in nirvana. But, you know, I think that is a very confused way to think. Very confused way to think. And later Buddhism definitely rejected that idea. You know, in Zen we actually say samsara is nirvana. And samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. That's what we actually believe. You can think, how is that possible? Well, you know, maybe 600 years after the Buddha, there was a very famous monk named Nagarjuna. And when we do our abbreviated Dharma lineage, we recite his name, Nagarjuna. And, you know, Nagarjuna said something that's really profound and has had a big impact on Zen. He said, this exists because of that, and that exists because of this. And if that doesn't exist, know this. And if this doesn't exist, then there's not going to be any that. You know, in Buddhism, this is called the teaching of dependent origination. In other words, nothing exists by itself. You know, everything only exists because of everything else, you could say, you know. So, and we know this in a certain way, right? So look, you know, you can't have grass without clouds, because the grass needs the rain, right? So, you know, if you plant grass and there's no rain, the grass dies. You can't have grass without rain, without water, right? And there's no world in which grass can exist without water. They're mutually, you could say, co-creating, right? Same thing with, you know, like plants take in CO2 and exhale oxygen, right? So if plants can't get CO2, they will die. And if we can't get oxygen, we will die. So you know, terrestrial animals need oxygen, and plants need CO2, see? So you can't. There's no world in which it's possible to have terrestrial mammals without oxygen, and you can't have oxygen without trees and grass. See. So you know we know in a certain way that everything is dependently arising. You know, you can only have grass if you have water. You can only have water if you have liquid water. And you can only have water if you have rain, and so on and so on. You can't get grass by itself. You can't have terrestrial mammals without plants. You know, and the evolution of life on our planet is like a textbook case of dependent origination. You know, we think in terms of I am separate from everything else. You know, so, but you can play a little game. You can say, okay, well, what would I be like if my mother had not left, married my father, right? You know, what if my father had married somebody else? Well, you know, would you be that, would you be your father's child or your mother's child, right? I mean, it's absurd to think that way because you couldn't exist without your particular father and your particular mother. If your father had married someone else, you wouldn't be an inch taller or shorter. You wouldn't exist, right? This is hard for us to think about because we do, I mean, when I was a teenager, I had many fantasies about having been adopted. And I also had fantasies that maybe, you know, maybe my father wasn't my real father, you know, maybe. But you know, really, I couldn't be who I am without my father, right? You know, we didn't get along, but I wouldn't be who I am without my father. So you know, dependent origination is really important. We don't think this way normally. We don't think this way, but we have no independent existence. You know, who we are depends entirely on all the things that have happened to us. You know? It's not the case, really, that that if we had grown up in a different state and if we had gone to a different school, and, you know, if we did, we would like to think our life would be better, you know, if there wasn't a bully living next door when you were 6 years old, the guy who used to beat you up, right? Life would be so much better without him. But you know, dependent origination says you couldn't be who you are now without that bully, see? So everything you are, it was created by everything you've gone through. And it's a fantasy to imagine that you could be a different person than the one you are. It's a fantasy. Because you are a product of dependent origination and nothing else. You are like the sum total of everything that has happened to you. So, you know, when people practice Zen, you know, we might say to ourselves, you know, why can't I just, you know, I remember when I was practicing Zen with Genki Roshi, I was working on these koans and I couldn't answer the koans. And I wanted so much to wake up. I wanted so much to have this breakthrough experience that would totally transform my life. And I remember I would even have dreams, you know, I would have these dreams where I would be staring at a wall and I would see the Buddha's face and I would go into Genki Roshi and Dokusan and say, I had this dream, I saw the Buddha's face, and, you know, Genki Roshi would just ring the bell, you know, that wasn't the answer to my koan, you know. Why do I have to have these obstacles? Why do my legs have to hurt? Why does this have to be so hard? Why can't I just be awake? Why can't I just be in nirvana, right? That's a very confused way to think about things. You know, everything that has happened to us is helping us to wake up. You know, the desire we have to wake up is the product of all the suffering we have experienced. And without that suffering, it's highly unlikely we would be the people we are today or have the desire to wake up. You know, so one way to think about Zen practice is that, you know, ordinary life is like a nightmare and you're trying to awaken from it. But another way to think about all the things that have happened in your life is that they're helping you to wake up. They're all part of these what are called cooperating causes in a complex system in which everything is dependently arising. Without this, know that, you know. So I guess, you know, when I was living in Baltimore, and I used to be afraid to go to school because Bobby Westbrook would beat me up, I'm not happy that that happened to me, you know. And in my fantasies, I'm a foot taller and I beat him up, but it never really happened, you know. I still kind of hate Bobby Westbrook. But on the other hand, you know, I might not have become Genki Roshi's student if it weren't for Bobby Westbrook, you know. And it's definitely the case that when I was practicing Zen, I had to work through a lot of anger that was produced by people like Bobby Westbrook. But on the other hand, you know, what we call obstacles are not obstacles. They are the ground of your awakening. What we call obstacles are not obstacles. They are the ground of your awakening. So nothing can be done without these obstacles. There's no enlightenment is really possible without these obstacles. It's not the case that there's something called samsara and there's something called nirvana. It's like you are moving towards awakening. And without these painful and difficult experiences, and without these obstacles, awakening would be impossible. You know, impossible. You know, you can't have oxygen without plants. You can't have enlightenment without painful experiences. Right? You can't have enlightenment without confusion. So this is not how the human mind works. We like to divide things very neatly and clearly. You know, there's the beginning and the end. You know, there's the bad and the good. But it's really not like that. You know, everything that's happened to you is helping you to wake up. You know, any compassion, any loving kindness you experience or you're capable of displaying in your life comes out of all these things, some of which were quite terrible to you, right? When you sit down on the cushion and you can't answer your koan, you have to realize that this is making your future awakening possible. You know, this is not a rationalization. Our minds have a hard time thinking about what Nagarjuna said. Without this, know that. See, without that, this is not possible. So, you know, we love to live in imaginary worlds, but the real world is exactly the world we're living in now. And all the things that have happened to us it's like the ground of our awakening. And without them, no awakening is possible. It would have been nice for Yamamoto Genpo Roshi not to have gone blind. But Yamamoto Genpo Roshi would not have become Yamamoto Genpo Roshi without his blindness. It was the ground of his awakening. You know, my friend Michael would have preferred to have a loving father who did not beat him up and lock him in a closet and inflict narcolepsy on him. But nevertheless, you know, he became a most astonishing person because of these things. Another very wonderful saying in Zen is, you know, everything is your rice. Everything is your rice. You know, you just have to lean down and eat. You know, everything is helping you wake up. Everything is rice. You know, we don't necessarily want the food we're served in life, but all of it can be nourishing or will be nourishing if we sit there long enough on the cushion and we understand how it's making our awakening possible. You know, the best koans are not the koans people can answer easily. The best koans are the koans that are hard to work through. Those are the ones that really open the windows in people's minds, you know. Thing, you know, even after people have their Daikensho, you still have to work. You still have knots to untie, karma to clean up. It's like you need that food too, right? You need that food too to deepen your awakening. You know, Kensho, awakening, Daikensho, is not the end of the process. It's really like the beginning of a longer process. It's a way of living with openness to what's actually happening. You know, for now, just say to yourself, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. The universe is too narrow. The sun, moon, and stars are all at once darkened. Even if blows from the stick, the teaching stick that I talked about, fall like raindrops, and the katsu shouts sound like thunder, you are still far short of the truth of Buddhism, which is, everything is my rice. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the patriarchs of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate its profundity. The whole treasury of sutras is inadequate to expound its deep meaning. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to save themselves. At this point, how do you conduct yourself? Mentioning the name of the Buddha is like trudging through the mire. To utter the word Zen is to cover your face with shame. Not only those who have long practiced Zen, but beginners too should exert themselves to attain directly the secret. Everything is helping me wake up. Main subject. Joshu said to the assembly, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. With but a single word, there may arise clarity, or there may arise confusion. But this old monk does not have clarity. Do you understand?" Then a monk asked, "If you don't have clarity, how can you appreciate anything?" Joshu said, "I don't know." The monk said, "If you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity?" Joshu said, "Good question. Now let's retire." Secho's verse, "The great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many faces, two with one. Far away in the heavens the sun shines, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten." See, you're not a skull. You have, you're alive. You're not a dead tree. You're alive. You know, being alive means, you know, sometimes you have a flat tire. Sometimes you get sick. Sometimes you get a pink slip. You know, but it's everything is helping you wake up. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret.